G'day wherever you may be around the world, and thank you for joining us once again. It is time for the Cultured Karaite on truth2u.org, truth2letteru.org. I'm Jono, and joining me is Hani and the Cultured Karaite. G'day, girls.
Hello.
G'day. I had a good day today.
Hey. I'm glad you had a good day.
I was with Aussies today. Ooh.
That makes every day good. I get to be with Aussies every day.
I know. I get to be with you guys tonight. I got to meet Kate and James Robertson from Australia. They're in Texas. Yeah.
G'day, Kate. G'day, James. Kate. James has been around here with his son. I've met James before.
Yeah. Good shout out to those fine folks.
Mm. I made some chocolate brownies for him.
I think he did make some. How about that? He reigns from the other side of Australia, which may as well be another country. Yeah. I mean, it's so far away, but he's right over the other side on the west side, I do believe.
Yes, he said it. They were telling me that it's very warm there.
That's an understatement, Deb. It's humid and severely hot. I would say.
Yeah, their kefir makes really quickly.
I bet.
We had lunch today, and we were talking about the kefir and fermented vegetables, and they've got great success with that, but they get done much more quickly than mine do.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt it would favor that. Very good, very good. Well, shout out to those guys, and also a shout out to James Heyman. Jim, g'day to Jim. He actually he left a comment on the last program that we did in regards to grapes in the Tanakh. And he made mention of something called wild Texas grape. What's that about?
Well, we do have several varieties in Texas. One's muscadine, which I can remember having muscadine jelly when I was a little girl. It was so good. But I did buy, and it was really interesting because evidently these grapes he was talking about just became ripe. And they're called frost grapes, and they are edible, and they do not become ripe and edible until after the first frost here in Texas, and we've had that. And so to James, you pick those and you can make some jam and jelly out of those, and they should be great. They should be real.
jam and jelly. Can you make frost wine, frost grape wine or anything?
It doesn't say what I looked up on
I suppose there's always a there's
but I don't see why not with. Yeah,
have a go, Jim, and let us know.
Yeah,
because that was the topic of the last conversation. Hey, now, Hani, grapes, what are they? I mean, we always wait until they're super, super cheap before we just pile up on grapes, but we must be getting close to it.
Oh, they're still like $9 a kilo.
I want it to be cheaper than that.
No, it's February. It's late January, February.
Oh.
Wow.
All right. Anyhow.
But cherries. We've got cherries.
Ooh. Cherries, yep, cherries everywhere. Love the cherries. It's a great time of the year. In fact, I just pulled some apricots off the tree.
Oh.
And we've spoken about that, and we've spoken about the apricot almond as well. Almond is what I said with an L. and how good that can be for you as well. Lots of things going on in the garden. Boy, I love the garden, Dev, because I don't know. It's just this time of the year I want to be out in the garden and just getting things growing. And boy, it's hot at the moment, and it's hard to be in the sun. But and we haven't had any rain. My goodness, we had like 2 mil of rain, and that's all it did on Shabbat, which was nice. I'm not complaining, but we need some more. I mean, I know, are you guys still in drought over there, or what?
We are. We're in a severe drought, and it's really hurting now bad.
Mm.
We are in severe drought. It's not good.
It's not good. We know what that's like. I mean, we did come out of drought, about 10 years of drought, just a couple of years ago, but it's been a real odd start to the summer since then. We've had very, very little rain. In fact, I think, if I remember correctly, I think we've had something like 17 mil in the last, 2-3 months. It's been...
Yeah.
But
thankfully, we're very blessed with a good well, with good bore water here. So
We are.
We have underground water, yeah.
That's great. Yeah, I heard the water in Darwin was really good too.
Is that right?
Yeah, we don't have such good
out of the
water
ground.
Here. Yeah.
So you don't have much groundwater in Texas?
They've used a lot of it for, what they call fracking. And they've really hurt the Texas aquifer here because of the fracking. They've pumped a lot of it out to the way they extract gas out of shale requires a lot of water.
Wow.
Yeah. It's really hurt. They, they'll say, oh, no, it hasn't. But that's just absolutely not true. It's hurt. Mm. It's hurt the aquifer. Yeah.
That is a shame. Well, in any case, We were talking about grapes last time we spoke. What are we speaking about this week, Dev?
Oh, we can't talk.
Was that a ho, 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 ho? Yeah. Did you just say ho, 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 ho?
Oh, this time of year.
Tis the season to be jolly, Dev.
It is. It's rubbed off on me. Did you? I posted a cute cartoon today that the Frosty the Snowman was caught picking his nose, and he's standing in front of a bin of carrots.
Actually, our kids saw that.
He's in the fruit and vegetable aisle.
Yeah. Our kids saw that one on Facebook that you posted, and they were all giggling around the computer this morning. I thought that was hilarious.
He's an important in the list of Christian gods, Frosty the Snowman. He's right up there with Satan and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer and the Easter Bunny and Santa.
We're not here. It's too hot for Frosty the Snowman. It's one thing for Santa Claus to be running around in his woolen red suit in 105 degree heat. Frosty the Snowman would just be a puddle on the floor.
It'd be a puddle on the floor. But I remember when I was little, Dev. Sorry, I mean, I know we were going to get to what we're talking about this week. But you started it with ho, ho, ho. But I remember as a kid, you know, in the Christian tradition that I came from, that, you know, we would be indoctrinated with all the, this time of the year, we'd be indoctrinated with all these crazy puppet-like cartoons and things on the television with these characters with these superpowers that would somehow be related to the baby Jesus, and we were never too sure how exactly that worked, and because it never really appeared in the Bible, but you know, somewhere along the line these semi-gods were able to perform, you know, all sorts of magical things, and we thought, well, this is pretty tricko, eh? Interesting.
Nope, that's why we don't have TV anymore.
Yeah,
no, well, that's also one of the reasons why we don't have TV anymore. Yeah. But, you know, it's a funny thing because, like, over here in the, you know, in Australia, I'm sure maybe it's the same for you, we might look at a very different culture, like, and religion that goes with, like, say, for example, Hinduism. What is, honey, just quickly, give me some of the really crazy, at least as it appears to us, what are some of the really way out gods in Hinduism?
I don't know.
Oh, come on.
Oh, I can't think of any off the top of my head. I've only really sort of just touched the surface of Hinduism. But there's just millions of them. There's millions of them. There's the three major ones.
There's millions of them, and you can't think of
there's
one?
There's the Trinity. No, I can't. Don't put me on the spot like this.
She's got all this education, and you put her on the spot.
Yeah, come on.
I don't have education in Eastern religion.
Yeah, my point is there's the elephant with all the arms.
That's Ganesha. Yeah, Ganesha.
Well, you know the name of that.
But he's a minor god, I think.
Well, what do you think Frosty the Snowman is?
Oh, yeah, okay.
This is my point. Come on. And there's more major ones, the Hindu Trinity, sure. But, I mean, but there's all the – this is exactly my point. There's all the minor gods as well. And I wouldn't be surprised, Dev, honestly, I think about this, that someone in a Hindu culture switched on Western Christmas TV, right, you know, the kids' channel or whatever it is, and they've got these 1960s and 1970s puppet-like cartoony things going on, yeah, and they'd be thinking, man, you know, boy, the Christians worship some weird – they've got some weird gods. Look at this. Who's this? There's this Santa Claus guy. He travels the world. There's the red-nosed reindeer. There's the little drummer boy. There's this Satan thing, and there's the Frosty the Snowman, and look at them. They're all really, really odd. And you know, I wouldn't blame them for having a look at that, coming to that conclusion. I think it's equally as odd for us when we look at Daz and go, "What's with the elephant with all the arms?"
Exactly. You know, I have to just say real quick, and I'm probably going to catch a lot of flack for this, but I can't help it. I don't know how they do it in Australia, but at this time of year, people decorate the outside of their houses with a lot of decorations and lights, and it becomes they have contests here.
But the thing is, Dev, right? No. Okay, what's the temperature over there at the moment?
Well, it was warm today. Right now, it's 60 degrees.
Okay, so 60 degrees, and at nighttime, what does it go down to?
It's going to be about 55.
It's going to be about 55. It's 100 here, Dev, and they do the same thing.
Wow.
They spray pretend snow frost around the windows, and they and they do all these weird wintry Christmas things. It's even more bizarre over here. Oh my goodness, what is wrong with people? I don't understand it.
Well, and see, my biggest thing is that I see all of this opulence of all of these lights, and I know how much money was spent on them, and I think to myself, if each household took that money that they were going to spend on those opulent decorations and all those lights and all that stuff, and gave to the poor, gave to poor children, you know, gave to the poor.
Come on, the poor people could come and look at the lights and get the Christmas little cheer.
okay.
It's all about.
Okey-dokey.
Sharing the love.
I forgot about that.
No, there's a guy down the road, Dev. There's a guy down the road that spent, I don't know how much on the lighting. I mean, he's literally covered his house and garden.
Wow.
If I was his neighbor, I would not be happy. But he's done this. It's made him happy, and everyone who's into the Christmas thing, they love it. But he said, you know, it adds, you know, probably now because the price of electricity has gone up considerably here in Australia, in New South Wales where we are, probably added a couple hundred bucks just to his
electricity
bill. But it's worth it to them, and it's
worth it to him because of the Christmas cheer that it brings him and his family and the whole neighborhood.
Yeah. Okay.
There's a lot of psychology behind all this.
There is, and I, you know, and there's also there's still children that are going to bed hungry.
But at least they have a warm feeling in their tummy,
their
heart.
Warm and fuzzy feeling in their grumbling tummy because they're hungry.
It gets to me. I'm sorry. It does.
Well,
it just
yes.
It's a funny religion. Anyway, what are we talking about this week? Yeah.
We better start talking about it or we're going to be in trouble. we just can't talk about the beautiful, you know, rich fruits and things that grow in Israel and that Jehovah made. And seems like to me, because he says so many things in the Tanakh about these things, we can't leave out olives. Oh, my goodness.
Oh, we've got to talk about them.
We can't leave out olives. And so I found olives in the Tanakh, 36 verses worth of verses. Now, some of them, you know, I have to admit, it talks about the Mount of Olives. So it's not specifically talking about the fruit. But I picked out three or four verses that just really, you know, moved me or were special to me, or I felt like I got what, you know, Jehovah was really trying to say, that, you know, by giving us these fruit, these grapes, these figs, these olives, you know, that these are blessings. These are huge blessings of food and rich soil and commerce and, you know, all the good things that come with that bumper crop of good things. And if you want to read it, that's fine. I don't mind reading it. But the first one I wanted to touch on was Deuteronomy 6:11.
Deuteronomy 6:11.
Maybe we even should back up to 10.
I've got it here. This is what it says, and I even have a little subheading in my New King James Study Bible, and it says just above 10. It says caution against disobedience, and it says, "So it shall be when Jehovah your God brings you into the land of which He swore to your fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to give you, large and beautiful cities, which you did not build." Houses full of good things, which you did not fill, hewn out wells, which you did not dig, vineyards and olive trees, which you did not plant. When you have eaten and are full, then beware lest you forget Jehovah, who brought you out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage. You shall fear Jehovah your God and serve him, and you shall take oaths in his name. You shall not go after other gods, the gods like the multi-armed elephant or Frosty the Snowman, the gods of the people who are all around you, for Jehovah your God is a jealous God among you, lest the anger of Jehovah your God be aroused against you and destroy you from the face of the earth.
Isn't that something? They didn't even have to plant these things. They were there.
Yeah. They were there.
Yeah. You don't have to do anything. Just come in and start eating. Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
Adam. Adam was created, and he had pre-garden.
Right, right. Here it is.
There it was.
Know.
Garden done.
What an amazing blessing. You know, it's just well. Anyway, the next one that I picked out of the when I'm looking over the 36 was Psalm 128:3, and this just was absolutely beautiful. And I've got a little story to tell after we do this Psalm 128:3, and then we get into Zechariah 4. I've got a little story to tell, but let's read that one if you don't mind.
Can I read the whole thing? Because it's
it's beautiful.
It's a winner, and I've been a big fan of 127. Is one of my favorites, but 128. And again, I've got a little subheading here. It says blessings to those who fear Yehovah. Blessed is everyone who fears Yehovah, who walks in his ways. When you eat the labor of your hands, you shall be happy, and it shall be well with you. Oh, that is so true, Deb.
It is.
It's just so cool when you plant a garden, and then eventually, you know, something grows that you can eat, and you eat it, and you go, oh, that was so cool. I made that happen. It was really good. So your wife, oh, that's you, honey, quick. Your wife shall be like a fruitful vine in the very heart of your house, your children like olive plants all around your table. Behold, thus shall be the man, she shall be blessed who fears Yehovah. Yehovah bless you out of Zion. Oh, this is worth reading, Deb. This is great.
It is.
Yehovah bless you out of Zion, and may you see the good of Jerusalem all the days of your life. Yes, may you see your children's children. Peace be upon Israel. Oh, that's beautiful.
Hallelujah! Woo!
Hallelujah!
Woo! That is just... Oh, that's phenomenal. Well, I want everybody to remember your children will be like olive plants. I want you to remember that. Should we go to Zechariah chapter 4 and get real controversial?
We can do that, but did you say you wanted to tell a story about this one?
Well, it also includes Zechariah chapter 4.
Ooh, okay,
so
let's do it.
Before we go, can I just ask a question? Like when it says your children will be like olive shoots, what does that actually mean? What does an olive shoot do?
Have you got olive shoots? No, yeah. I've got your children like olive plants.
I've got shoots in the shoots. This is the NSAB.
Hang on.
I'm gonna get another translation here.
Okay, it's a shitiel, which is a plant or a shoot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, hold on.
Well,
as in a
young olive shoot.
Right. Yeah. And that's what I want to talk about in just a minute after if we can.
Zechariah, we'll do that. And what translation are you looking at there, Deb?
I think this is the King James.
I've got in this one, it says that your sons, I've got your sons like olive saplings around your table. Saplings. So I suppose that's
so young, a young plant.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Right. Yep.
But is there something characteristic about that, or is it just...
I learned some things when I was in Israel I kind of want to share.
So let me read this one first, and then we'll touch on that. So which one? Zechariah chapter 4, verse...
Well, we can start at the beginning.
I think I'm going to have to do the whole thing. This is the whole chapter, Deb, because it's got again, my little subheading. I've got a vision of the lampstand and olive trees. And it says, this is Zechariah chapter 4, now the angel who talked, I don't like angel, I like to say messenger. Now the messenger who talked with me came back and wakened me as a man who is wakened out of his sleep, as he was, and he said to me, what do you see? And I said, I'm looking, and there's a lampstand of solid gold with a bowl on top of it. And on the stand, seven lamps with seven pipes to the seven lamps, two olive trees by it, one at the right of the bowl and the other at the left. So I answered and I spoke to the messenger who talks with me, saying, what is this? What are these, my Lord? He says. And the messenger who talks with me answered and said to me, do you not know what these are? Don't you love these kind of conversations? It's like I asked you what they are. If I knew what they were, I wouldn't ask. Come on. And so I said, no. No, I don't. I don't know, my Lord. And so he answered me and said to me, okay, this is the word of Yehovah to Zerubbabel. Not by might nor by power, but by my spirit, says Yehovah of hosts. Boy, how many times have we heard that out of context? Who are you, O great mountain? Before Zerubbabel you shall become a plain, and he shall bring forth the capstone with great shouts of grace to it. Now that's interesting. Moreover, the word of the Yehovah came to me, saying, the hands of Zerubbabel have laid the foundation of this temple. His hands shall also finish it. Then you will know that Yehovah of hosts has sent me to you. For who has despised the day of small things. For these seven rejoiced to see the plumb line in the hand of Zerubbabel. They are the eyes of Yehovah, which scan to and fro throughout the whole earth. Then I answered and said to him, what are these two olive trees at the right and of the lampstand and to the left? And I further answered and said to him, what are these two olive branches that drip into the receptacles of the two gold pipes from which the golden oil drains? And then he said to me, he answered me and he said, do you not know what these are? Oh, man, that would
be, here we go.
That'd bug me. Come on, dude. And he said, no, that's why I asked. And so he said, these are the two anointed ones who stand beside Yehovah at the of the whole earth. These are the two anointed ones. What do you make of that, Deb?
Well, I believe and I see that this is the king and the high priest to come.
Well, that makes sense.
These are the two anointed leaders that Yehovah will anoint. One is a king and one is a high priest, and he likens them to olive trees.
So these are the, now in the Hebrew, do you have the Hebrew in front? Does it say these are the two messiahs?
No, no, it does not.
And yet they are, right? These are two Mashiach. There are two. There's the high priest and there's the king.
Right.
There's two.
And as far as I've been able to determine in the whole Tanakh, the actual term Mashiach is not used to describe these two to come. But these definitely are the anointed leaders to come, the king from the line of David and the mm-hmm. high priest from the line of Levi.
Mm-hmm.
But it's what struck me about this, because I've had this understanding for quite a while, but when I really got to researching out the things about olives, you know, it began to really strike me the picture that this puts in your mind. And what I learned when I was in Israel about olive trees, we were traveling around, and we were with Nehemiah, and he took us to an olive grove, and he said, do you want to see some 2,000-year-old olive trees? And we were like, you know, you're kidding me. And he said, no. And he said, they're, you know, they don't know for sure, but there are some extremely, extremely old olive trees in Israel, and they're reckoning them 1,000, you know, to 2,000 years old. And so they, you know, and they do, they know that there are some that are hundreds of years old, these things, that they do know about. But anyway, we went to this grove, and some of these olive trees, there you could not get your arms around them. They were wow. so huge around the trunk. There was absolutely no way you could get your arms around them. Wow. But I stood there, you know, looking at them, and he said, what do you see? And, you know, I don't have a big background in gardening or things like that, but I have gardened a lot in my life, and I stood there looking, and, you know, he said, start telling me what you see. Well, around the base of the olive tree are these little shoots that are coming up that are like little olive sticks with the little bitty olive leaves on them.
Mm-hmm.
And some were already closer to the tree. Some were, you know, several inches away from the base of the bottom. And I started looking and realizing that this trunk was not smooth. It had like... they're kind of halfway rounded parts of it that were growing up, and those things that grew up and they were kind of melded into the trunk, and there was like one after the other on all sides of the olive tree. And I begin to realize that as these little shoots at the bottom grow up, they kind of meld themselves into the side of the tree, and they continue to grow, and they actually form around the main trunk, which is in the very middle.
Mm-hmm.
But they just keep growing, and they keep they're like knotted and gnarly, but it's like arms, you know, growing up and melding in. And as it melds, the tree gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and you can actually kind of like run your hand up one of these branches that's just, you know, more than halfway, you know, melded into the trunk. And then at the top, it becomes a like what we know as a real branch with leaves on it. But the trunk is one of these little shoots that has grafted itself on to this tree, and, you know, and one on the other side, and one on, until the tree is growing fatter and fatter and fatter. And they grow on up, you know, and have real branches. But it's these little shoots all around the tree that are continually, the roots are putting off, and it keeps continually making the trunk bigger and bigger and bigger.
Can I just make sure I understand that? Because we've got olive trees, Deb, and we've actually got an olive grove next door, and there's quite a number of them around where we are in the country here. But I look at my olive trees, and they're quite thin and slender, and they're not knotty, and they're not, you know, very barky or anything like that. They're really quite smooth and nice, but they're quite young. I don't know how many years old they are, but I'm guessing maybe one of them I know is about 7 years. I guess the other one maybe 20 years. I don't know. But are you, because melding, I'm not too sure what you mean by that, but are you saying that when they come out of the roots at the bottom of the main trunk, they sort of hug along the side of the main trunk and become one with the trunk and continue to grow that way,
right?
So that's how it's not just that the trunk itself is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, but that the shoots that it also springs forth around the base and around the sides of the trunk, that they grow up around the trunk and become one with the trunk. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and you can actually you can trace the branches as they're joined with this trunk. You can see them. Of course, they'll become knotty or twisted, or you know, as they're growing up. But you can actually pick out the branch that you can see
and follow it on up.
Yeah, and it's I stood there and I thought to myself, this is an amazing picture in nature, that the way Yehovah did this, and the pictures that he paints with these words of the nation, you know, joining together, you know, grafting together and making something extremely strong, and something, you know, and more coming in and joining it, and mm-hmm. and then attaching itself to the main trunk and growing on up and making it even stronger and this is to me was a picture of the nation of Israel right there in front of me. Because Jonah, the tradition I came from didn't have a national identity. And one mm-hmm. of the things that I've learned is, and has become extremely important to me, is that national identity that I'm no longer, and I don't know how to say this exactly, but I look at the well-being of my nation first. I don't look to my well-being, you know, so much first. And I realize that there are other people in the nation who look to my well-being. And together, you know, what a strength that mm-hmm. I know somebody's got my back. Somebody knows I've got their back, and we have a national identity. And I think that, you know, when Yehovah addresses the nation throughout the Tanakh, that's what he's doing, is addressing the nation, not so much individuals. And mm-hmm. I have learned to gain that national identity as I've grown over the last few years. And when I looked at that olive tree and then realized, you know, your children are like the olive plants round about, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, look at these little shoots coming up. And then they join, you know, they meld to that trunk, and they make it stronger, and they make it larger, and they grow up in it. And it's a real national identity picture in my mind. And I was just astounded, and I thought that was interesting that he uses the olive trees to describe these two to come, these two messiahs. You know, what a national strength, you know, that these olive trees you know, show and give that picture of what our future is going to be like.
And that really does also, it adds so much to the question that Hani asked in regards to Psalm 128, that the children shall be like, in fact, I'm just going to get it again here in my Jewish Bible. It says, once again, so shall your sons be like olive saplings around your table. And that imagery really does add so much to that.
Oh, it's
It's amazing. Symptoms. When you're standing at this olive tree, and there's like tons of those little shoots. Here's something else that's even more amazing, is that olive root can send out one of those little shoots 50 yards away. Let's just say 50 yards away, and it'll start, it'll come up, and it'll make a whole new tree 50 yards away. And the same thing will begin to happen, is those little shoots will come up at the base and will begin to grow up, with the main trunk or the main shoot, and meld, graft itself in, meld itself in. And they're 50 yards away. You've got another tree off of the original tree. And so our nation continues, and it grows in strength, and then to me, that was like a picture of my grandchildren that I hope, someday will, make the nation even stronger than I hope to make it. The olive tree is just absolutely phenomenal, and just full of such a picture of Yehovah and his nation and how he sees it.
Amen. And that's only three passages, and there are many. And
there's 36, yeah.
Now, what about the fruit, the actual olive? Now, look, before we get onto that, can I tell a story, because this is fresh in my mind?
Yeah.
I've got last week, Deb, I went to Sydney and a couple of things to do, but while I was there, I caught up with Rabbi Lee Cohen. And of course, they were doing their Hanukkah thing, and I thought, oh well, this will be interesting. He and I are going to be talking about that, and particularly Hanukkah as it relates to the oral law. That's going to be an interesting conversation. But while I was there at their Hanukkah majiggy, I met a couple of Orthodox yeshiva students, and one of them was Hani, and the other one was Yossi. And Hani was from California, of all places. Yossi was from Argentina. And Yossi, he gave me the rundown on Hanukkah. And during the course of the evening, Dev, he did a olive press demonstration.
Wow.
I was really fascinated with that.
Yeah.
Because they had an olive press there, manual olive press. He had maybe just a fist size of olives that he put in, not very many. And everyone had a turn of tightening the olive press, and of course the juice came out, and then he took the juice and put it into, now usually he said that, they would sit it somewhere and it'd take a few days for the oil to separate in the juice and rise to the top. He put it in a little machine that did that very, very quickly, spun around. And he did that, and then he took it out. He removed the oil from the top and put it into a lamp, and lo and behold, the lamp lit up. When he lit it, there it was, and it had fuel. And so he did the whole thing while I was there, and I just thought that was really cool. And obviously, I mean, I love olives, Deb. I love them.
Oh, I do too.
They're so delish. But here is obviously another use for it, the olive oil, and it's quite an involved process. And Hani, I mean, wasn't it in the Middle East for such a long time, and I suppose it still is, but back in the day, it was the fuel, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, in the whole Mediterranean. Yeah. I mean, this is what the Greeks are famous for, you know? Well, among other things.
Sure.
A few other things, but you know.
But it was the fuel. What was the other uses for olive oil? I mean, it was fuel. It was
soap.
Soap.
Yeah, soap.
They used to put it on their bodies and then scrape it off with a scraper.
Unreal.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would kind of prefer the shower, yeah. But there it is, Dev. The olive fruit.
Well, let me tell you. Let me just throw this in. There's something called oil cleansing method, and I came across this and I thought, well, what is that? And you take a mixture of olive oil, and I used grapeseed oil and castor bean oil. I used equal parts, and I've been doing this for about 3 weeks now. I've been, instead of washing my face with soap or whatever, I'm not scraping it off.
You haven't got a piece of pottery that you're scraping on. Okay.
I didn't do that, but I am using this oil cleansing method with these three oils I mixed together, and my complexion has improved. And I gotta admit, I'm kind of shocked, and I I don't want anybody out there to go, ooh, she's not using soap anymore. But I have not used soap on my face. I've used warm water and this oil, and believe it or not, I had a few blackheads across my nose, a few tiny blackheads, and I'm thinking, you know, this is crazy. I'm too old for this. But this has gotten rid of them because oil dissolves oil. I don't know exactly, or it breaks it up. I don't know what, and I don't have blackheads anymore across my nose. That it's really taken care of it. And I really do like the moisturization that it gives. So I'm not scraping it off with pottery, but I'm telling you, this oil cleansing method is working for me. I'm really tickled about it. But the olives...
I've known, but before you go on, I have met a number of people that have used, that do use olive oil as a daily moisturizer on their face.
Well, I use coconut oil.
Yeah, you use coconut oil. Yeah.
I have to use.
And I've used it too, but I heard that, oh gosh, now I can't even think of her name, that beautiful actress from Italy, she's older now, but she was Sophia Loren. I've always read that she used olive oil and nothing else on her face. So
I want to see where all these people in the 70s with the oil of Yulan ads that
we
had to endure.
I
want to see where they are now. Never hear about them.
That's right.
No, you don't. What's a Yulan, by the way?
It wasn't even
And do
oil.
We really want to put the poor Yulan's oil on our face? Anyway, but olive oil, coconut oil, but olive oil on the face, not just as a moisturizer, but as a cleanser.
Yeah.
Interesting.
It's working. It's working. Well, but the olive, oh my goodness, the nutrients, they are so health protective, packed nutrients in an olive. And, you know, that's not surprising that they're full of the flavanols and the antioxidants and the phytonutrients. They are just loaded. Matter of fact, one of the biggest studies that honed in on the calcium, it helps the bone. You won't have as much bone loss if you're consuming olives and olive oil because of some of the key phytonutrients. And that's one of the biggest studies because they keyed in on the fact that the people with the Mediterranean diet had such good, strong bones. And they attribute part of that to the olives.
Really?
So, yeah.
Very interesting. Yep. And now, see, when I talk to you, Deb, you always make me hungry. And now I'm thinking about how you can drizzle your olive oil over your breads instead of butter.
Yeah.
But certainly, and even better, not just put olives in your salad, but to drizzle a little bit of maybe olive oil and balsamic vinegar over your salads. That's a winner, isn't it?
Oh, that's so delicious. That is just amazingly delicious.
It's a good thing.
There's a research that shows that olives and olive oil, but I guess in particular olives, lower histamine. They're antihistamines. They lower a histamine response at the cellular level, and it's quite effective. You know, for people who have allergies, to be able to lower that histamine response at the cellular level, and it's a key player in the anti-inflammatory process. So it has many anti-inflammatory benefits. And, you know, that's what we hear so much about these days, is trying to make sure we lower our chance of, you know, getting inflammation, you know, by staying away from the sugar and the carbs and those things, and having the good whole foods as Jehovah made them.
Mm. Amen.
Yeah,
well, I didn't know that either.
Well, you should load up on olives when you're...
when I'm in Israel.
Yeah. No. I mean, when you've got your hay fever, you should start eating olives. That might help.
Okay. Well, no, that's interesting because one of the I do have in veggie capsules a natural, because I don't like taking chemicals, Deb. I just don't.
Yeah.
When it comes to medication, but when it gets really bad, like if I've got to go out and do something, I'll just have one of these capsules that have. Now I'm trying to remember what all the ingredients are, but I know one of the ingredients is olive leaf.
Mm, yeah.
And that's specifically for hay fever, for sinuses and whatnot. And one of the active ingredients is olive leaf.
Well, and that's the thing, you know, another thing about this is that every part of the plant is good for something. The fruit, the oil, the leaf, you know, the whole thing, you know, is really very beneficial. Some anti-cancer benefits that they're, you know, they're just now discovering. And a lot of that has to do with being an anti-inflammatory. So there's just many benefits to them. And besides that, they're so delicious.
And they are so delicious. I love them. I love them.
Lovely.
Now, there is, I have a question, though. I mean, I know that I didn't know about the anti-inflammatory, so I'm going to have to keep that in the back of my mind. But fermentation. Now, when you get your olives, are they fermented? Is that why they've got, you know, like if I buy them in a glass jar, oh boy, when we go to the supermarket, I don't buy anything with, like, I know what all the numbers are now. And it takes a while to be aware of the numbers that are okay and the numbers that aren't okay. You know, in the ingredients, and they give you the numbers rather than tell you what they are. It's just got a number. And there's only one brand that has no numbers, and it's all natural. Now, honey, do they put it in vinegar or in a salt vinegar solution? What is that?
Yeah, I think the commercial one is vinegar. But there's other ways of doing it, isn't there, Dave?
There's actually three that are talked about, you know, more than any others. And one of them is fermentation, is what they call brine curing, which, you know, is just a salt water, you know, brine that you leave them in until they ferment.
Right. So this other thing is basically a pickling sort of solution.
Vinegar and salt. So, but you can ferment them. And so how does that taste? Have you done that? Have you done the experiment?
Well, I've had the Greek olives. I haven't tried it myself, but I've had the Greek olives and the Sicilian style olives. And those are fermented. Those are absolutely delicious. They have a method called water curing where you just leave them in water, but it actually causes the olive to retain some of the bitterness of a, you know, a fresh olive off the tree is going to taste very bitter.
So, oh, I've done it. I've done it.
Yeah.
I'm not going to do it again.
not so good. So you have the water curing and then you have the brine curing, which is fermenting the olives. And that's done, you know, still a lot today. And there's something called lye curing, where they're submerged in alkali solution that's either sodium hydroxide or potassium hydroxide. So, if I've had a lye cured olive, I don't know it. You know, I don't know that I'd really know the difference. But I have had the.
So if I understand what you're saying, I mean, I don't know. I don't know if you know, but are you saying that? I mean, because there's all these different style of olives, right?
Right.
Is many of the different styles because of the way that they are preserved? Like some are fermented, whereas some are in a vinegar salt solution, for example. Like you said, the Greek olives are fermented. That suggested to me that there are some that just clearly aren't. But what makes the Greek olive Greek olives is the process by which they're preserved. Is that fair?
You know, to be honest, I don't know. I think it possibly may be. Of course, I do know there's olives that come off the tree green, and then as they are preserved, they turn black. There's olives that are on the tree they start off black and they stay black. So there's all kinds of different types. Well,
different
I should
techniques.
Say, you know, there's Kalamata olives. There's,
when you want to think of, Hindu gods, isn't it? It's like Hindu gods. When you have to think of them, they just leave your mind.
These names are, you know, they're in Italy. There's Cipriano olives. There's Pendolino olives. There's Lesiano. So there's tons of different, you know, types of olives, and but I would say that the way they're preserved is actually probably by region. Like in, you know, Italy and Greek, they've been preserving by fermentation for centuries and centuries and centuries, and that's how they still do it. So, you know, I'm not sure that necessarily has to do with how they turn out.
No, but I'm going to go and find it. I mean, I don't know if I can find some, but I'll see if I can find some fermented olives, ones that are preserved via fermentation, and have a go at that.
So there's one other question I wanted to ask before we go, just getting back to the oil. Now, I believe that you should not cook with olive oil. Is that the case?
That's my understanding. What will happen is olive oil can't be heated, you know, past a certain heat, and it's actually a pretty low heat. Even sautéing is too high for olive oil because of acrylamides. And do you remember we've talked about acrylamides, you know,
before?
Yeah, and some other things in olive oil actually changes composition when you heat it, and it's not good for you. So olive oil really should not be heated much, you know, like much past 100 degrees. And I don't know Hani's experience, but I've never been able to put a pan in the stove for less than 100 degrees.
No, you just can't do it.
No.
What is the point? So you generally would use, I think, sunflower oil is good.
Great.
Vegetable oils,
The best is really coconut oil.
That's what
coconut oil's all right.
Or just butter.
Butter, that's exactly. I use butter or coconut oil.
I do my eggs in butter.
Yeah.
So coconut oil is better on your salads, on your raw salads.
That olive oil.
What did I say?
Coconut oil.
Ooh! Do that to me. Olive oil on the salads.
Yes.
Or is there anything else that we want to throw into the mix of olives in the Tanakh?
I know, but oh gosh, I hope everybody will go and read about olives, because the Tanakh, you know, it's such a big part of the history to have these beautiful, beautiful foods and how well they grow in Israel. It's just amazing.
Mm. I'm looking forward to seeing that when I go in March. Really looking forward to seeing that, Dev, for the first time. And now, again, I'm going to have to go out and water my olive plants, because the poor things have – you're making me think about all – anyway, all right. So there it is, Cultured Karaite. The website is culturedkaraite.blogspot.com. culturedkaraite.blogspot.com. Dev, how's the Facebook group going?
It's going really well. We're having so much fun. And people get to that's the cool part. People get to jump in there and ask questions, and or they get to say, look what I did, and they get to post a picture of what they fermented, and you know, and everybody oohs and ahs, and it's just wonderful. We're having a real good time.
Good. Cultured Karaite on Facebook. There is a Cultured Karaite page. But you don't use that so much anymore. The Cultured Karaite group is what you want. So if you put in Cultured Karaite group on Facebook, you'll find Dev there. And get on the group, people. Get involved and start fermenting. And get into your olives and your figs and your grapes and all the wonderful things that that the Tanakh speaks about. Looking forward to speaking to you again soon, Dev. Thank you for that. And until then, dear listeners, be blessed and be set apart by the truth of our Father's word. Shalom. There you go.
That was good.
Just a bit too late. I just actually opened up the Katz's book, The Art of Fermentation, and he's got a whole little section here on brining olives.
Oh,
there you go.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Very
good.
Well, hopefully, I mean, I really like olive trees, simply just the way they look. They're always green and leafy, and I just love the way they look. But we've never actually benefited from a harvest. Now, my neighbor, who's our landlord, he has an olive grove, and he told us of the time they had a big harvest, and they collected it all, sent it off to a mate who extracted the oil, sent the oil back to him, and he had all this olive oil. They gave us a little bit. It was really good.
Oh,
and and I'm looking forward to, you know, these trees doing it, but apparently he told me they fruit only every couple of years or so.
They don't fruit every year.
They don't fruit every year. I didn't know that either. I'm going to be keeping an eye on my olive trees, because I would love to collect some olives and put them in a press. I don't know how much a press is.
And also, really cool. It takes 8 months to a year for them to cure.
Yeah, I should have said that. I did read that it takes much, much longer, you know, for them to ferment.
Really?
Yeah, yep. Heaps. Wow, listen to this. Whole intact olives take longer to cure than when you split them open. 8 months to a year. In such a long ferment, the surface typically becomes moldy. Remove surface growth as it forms, the submerged olives are fine. When the brine becomes dark with leached alluring pen, which I don't know what that is, drain the olives, discard the brine, and mix fresh brine. Don't add spices until a few months have passed and most of the bitterness has already been leached. Whole fermented olives generally retain their crunchiness better than olives with broken skins. It's really interesting.
I didn't know that part. But I did read a while ago that it takes much, much longer for them to ferment.
Yeah.
Well, I'm gonna leave all that in. What just remind the book. What is the book again?
Oh, it's Sandor Katz's book, The Art of Fermentation.
The Art of Fermentation. Mm-hmm. Okay. There it is, boys and girls. I'm gonna leave that bit in just for you, and now we're gonna go. Bye. Everyone say bye.
Bye-bye.